Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Author Chats. I'm Elizabeth Kelly. Today, we are glad to have with us Lynn Nanos, a social worker, to discuss with us her important and much-needed new book titled Breakdown, A Clinician's Experience in a Broken System of Emergency Psychiatry. Welcome, Lynn. Lynn? Well, I see Lynn in the queue, but for whatever reason, she is not connecting with us, and hopefully she can call back in a moment. In any event, Breakdown is an important and a much-needed book, as I just said, but it's also a book which is intensely readable, and it outlines why our mental health system is so broken. It should be treating people, but arguably it is mistreating them and leaving them to die, to suicide, to languish in our jails and our prisons. Things were not supposed to be like that. In 1963, President John Kennedy, in one of his last acts, signed the legislation that was basically intended to close our nation's mental health hospitals or state hospitals for people with mental disabilities and replace those systems with a network of community health treatment centers that would basically provide all the wraparound services like jobs, medication. I think I hear Lynn. Are you there?
I am.
Lynn? Good, good.
Yes,
I'm
here.
I apologize. You weren't connected at first, but I basically set the stage for you, and I've been telling our listeners that our system is broken and how it got to be like that. And I was talking about Kennedy's act that basically was going to close the state hospitals, leave them only for the most profoundly mentally disabled, and replace them by a network of community health treatment. Unfortunately, that has not happened over the past 50 so years. So what we have right now is deinstitutionalization replaced with transinstitutionalization. So from your perspective, tell us why our system is so broken.
Well, there are a number of factors that contribute to the broken system, and I've detailed these in Breakdown. There is the well-known shortage of inpatient psychiatric beds throughout the country. Since deinstitutionalization, approximately 96% of beds have been eliminated, and that has created a backlog in the hospital emergency rooms where patients end up waiting days, sometimes weeks, for beds to become available. And the premature discharges from inpatient units is a big problem because it contributes to the revolving door. Mm-hmm. When patients are discharged too quickly, obviously they're not stable, and they're going to be readmitted very, very quickly. And the involuntary hold laws are way too restrictive in most states, which makes it very hard for clinicians who are oftentimes well-meaning to get the patients connected to inpatient units.
And I should add for the benefit of our readers, in our book, in your book, when you talk about the revolving door, you list people who go in and out through the system 50 times. I mean, it's absurd, but these stories are true. Mm-hmm. They do happen.
Definitely. Every case vignette that I detailed is is based on truth. Of course, I changed the names and the
sure.
identifying data. But it's a very accurate book.
Mm-hmm. And I should also issue a disclaimer. You are not advocating that every single person with a mental disability be institutionalized, but what you are advocating is that the most seriously ill have access to appropriate treatment, correct?
Absolutely.
Now, one of the things that you also point out is that we have a huge number of people in our jails, in prisons, who have some type of mental disability. And the obstacle, of course, is they have committed a crime. So by virtue mm-hmm. of that, they're swept up in the criminal justice system. But what should we do about offenders who do have a mental disability? Are there some models out there that are particularly effective?
You raised some very interesting points, and I have been following what's been going on with the Supreme Court willingness to hear the appeal of the Kansas case. A few
yes.
states, as you know, don't allow the not guilty by reason of insanity defense, which, in my opinion, is appalling. I'm astonished that is allowed, given that we know of very sick people who should not be found guilty because of the offenses that they committed. They committed violence because of delusional beliefs, and this should not be punished. Another tactic is the increasingly popular crisis intervention teams that a lot of police departments have started to adopt. And I work very closely with such team at my place of employment. And they have been trained 40 hours in how to deal with mentally ill people in crisis. They learn about empathy and how to de-escalate people in crisis in more sensitive ways than traditional policing.
Yeah, and I'm going to play the devil's advocate for a moment, Lynn.
Okay.
CIT programs are sometimes criticized as being hug-a-thug programs. That is to say, suspects should not have empathy extended to them. And who cares about de-escalating a situation when someone's life is in danger? Indeed, a police officer's life is in danger. What's your response?
It depends on the type of case involved, and what you just stated, I'm sure, is what many in the public are thinking. And empathy, regardless of the situation, is critical. I have been empathic toward people who are not all that mentally ill, who lack motivation, who have malingered a million times to get into inpatient units just because they have nowhere to go and they've exhausted their support system and they absolutely do not deserve an inpatient bed. But these are human beings that need empathy, and empathy is one of the first skills that any mental health clinician learns in school. Mm-hmm. And
but police officers could say, hey, I am not a mental health worker. I am a police officer sworn to uphold the safety of the community. How would you
respond?
Sure.
There is such a thing as too much empathy, of course. Safety is paramount, and empathy is not going to prevent a shooting in some cases, and it's important to consider what is causing the potential for violence.
If
delusion is causing the aggressiveness, then empathy can be used to de-escalate that.
And for instance, some suspects may be suffering from PTSD, and the presence of a group of officers in uniform can be a hugely, hugely destabilizing and triggering experience for them.
Well, that's why the CIT officers do not wear traditional police uniforms. They also don't drive in police cruisers. Of course, they have to carry a gun and mm-hmm. other tools for physically restraining people, but it's not immediately obvious that they're police officers.
Now, if you've just tuned in, we're talking with Lynn Nanos, a social worker, about her new book titled Breakdown, A Clinician's Experience in a Broken System of Emergency Psychiatry. Now, Lynn, one of the terms that you use many times in your book is a great Scrabble work. And many of our listeners may not have encountered it. It is anosognosia. Tell our listeners, first of all, how you spell it, and secondly, what that is.
It's I'm writing this out, by the way, so I don't mess up. It's anosognosia. And there's a Greek word rooted in there, meaning to know, and it means the lack of knowledge, lack of awareness of one's illness is neurologically based, and I'm shocked that it's not one of the criteria in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, otherwise known as DSM, in diagnosing schizophrenia, because it's well known that more than half of those with schizophrenia, and my suspicion is it's even higher. I have found a lot more than half do not know that they are ill. And common sense tells us that if someone does not believe that she or he is ill, obviously they are not going to want any treatment. Why would they?
Mm-hmm.
If I have no illness, there would be no need for me to take any medication or go see a psychotherapist. And yet these very ill, probably the illest in the mental health field, engage in dangerous behaviors. And this is why involuntary treatment is needed. Most of the
involuntary... And the term that you use...
Yeah.
And is the term involuntary treatment the same as assisted outpatient treatment or AOT?
Yes and no.
Okay.
What I stated, yeah, the involuntary hold is the authorization that I have to have someone transferred to the hospital against their will. Whereas
okay.
assisted outpatient treatment is largely underused, and it involves usually through court orders, a very small number of recipients are not under court order, which many say is not even assisted outpatient treatment. The gold standard is the court order of outpatient treatment. Because of the black robe effect, which means that people are more likely to follow the instructions of a judge because of his or her authority, rather than outpatient providers or their family members. And research has shown time and again that this works. Yes.
Yeah, we only have a few seconds left, but I want you to address the concerns of many people who say that assisted out treatment is a profound infringement on someone's civil liberties.
Well, people with diabetes do not have the right to be sick. People with dementia do not have the right to be sick. It should not be the same in psychiatry. They need the help of outpatient providers and judges when they are not able to get the help that's needed. So this is partly philosophical, and another part of this is based in science, in that because of anosognosia, they will not get the help on their own.
Got it. Well, Lynn, that unfortunately is going to have to be the last word, but we've so enjoyed having you on Author Chats, and this is a wonderful book, and I commend it to all of my listeners, and hope that they will recommend it to other people, because as you point out in the book, mental disabilities, in particular mental illness, touches everyone in some fashion. We've been talking with Lynn Nanos, a social worker, about her book titled Breakdown, A Clinician's Experience in a Broken System of Emergency Psychiatry. I'm Elizabeth Kelly. Thank you for joining us on Author Chats. Please remember, injustice anywhere threatens justice everywhere. Have a good day.